You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Matt Brodsky is in the house, virtually at least. We're delighted to have him with us, a senior fellow with the Security Studies Group. He is a man who knows his way around the Middle East. He's been commenting on it, analyzing it, and addressing it for several decades now with considerable effect. And we're always delighted to catch up with him, especially when there's some important breaking news to be mulled, specifically about Turkey and the election that took place there yesterday that has affirmed the mandate for continued rule or misrule, as the case may be, of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Matt Brodsky, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So what are we to make of this election, Matt, and the prospect that this fellow who has, I think it's fair to say, fundamentally transformed Turkey from a secular pro-Western democracy to something very different? In fact, we've written a book recently called Turkey Ally No More, to sort of chronicle how different it is. He's going to be not only allowed to rule for another 5 years at least, but to have vastly broader powers as well. What are the implications of all of this?
Well, I think we need to look at the long-term trend and realize that with him, with Turkey being in NATO, which was, of course, set up to really stand against Russia's encroachment, what we have here is really Erdogan pretty much in league with Putin and the Russian model, both who want to recreate a previous empire. And for Erdogan, this is a Muslim Brotherhood version of a Ottoman Empire. They're basically gravitating toward each of what we in the West call the resistance camp. They'd like to kind of be in charge of that. So anytime that there is an act of terrorism by Palestinians, then you have Erdogan trying to take the lead as the strongest voice condemning Israel and comparing people to Nazis. We really, just looking at the trend, there's going to be a lot more that he will be sharing with Putin than he will be sharing with us. And it does not seem at all like a good parking spot to put an F-35 jet, which is from NATO, and to put an S-400, a world-class Russian air defense system. It's a horrible idea, and we're on track, perhaps, to see this happen.
Yeah, it's really troubling that at a moment when, as you say, the relationship between Erdogan and Putin is making increasingly common cause on military fronts, including sharing high technology, the S-400 as an example, that we would be continuing to share our state-of-the-art technology with the Erdogan government and presumably thereby facilitating its migration to the Russians. Speaking of all this, on the ground in Syria, the Turks, the Russians, their proxy Bashar Assad's government, and that other wild card in the deck, the Islamic Republic of Iran, are all jockeying for increased positions and territory in Syria post-civil war. Matt Brodsky, as you see it, how is that shaping up? And what in particular does it mean for the United States and those that it has been working with in that region?
Look, I have said for a while now that I think that U.S. policy in Syria has been a raging dumpster fire. And unfortunately, I have to say the same again. Specifically in southern Syria, I understand that the United States wants to keep its hands off the problem and that the Trump administration apparently views it as Obama's problem that's left over and that we should not be involved there. But what we have is a series of de-escalation zones for that Russia negotiated with Turkey and Iran in the western portion. But the one that was negotiated with the United States in Jordan and with Russia was for the Dara province, Weda, and Quneitra. These are the territories in Syria that are right next to the Israeli border and the Jordanian border. Now, we've been sending warnings that they should not violate the ceasefire, and Assad and Iran are doing that with Russian help today, which is basically going to put Jordan in quite a bind and essentially put Iran right on Israel's doorstep. Now, granted, Israel can act however it wants to push back against Iran. But the point is, the United States is the world power that I believe should be acting to balance out Russia. That's much more difficult for our allies who are smaller than us to do. And that's the position we're putting them in. So Iran is currently, switching uniforms so that they can pretend that they're Syrian soldiers and work in this attack formation in the south. And it's going to cause a lot of problems for us. And it further bolsters Russia's position in the Middle East, which, of course, is right under the southern flank of NATO. So there are things that we could do to enforce it, specifically launch a cruise missile at the airbase where we know that these airstrikes are coming from. If we did that, it sends a message that we stand by our word.
Well, the other wild card, again, is Iran, as you say, and the prospect that Israel will take matters into its own hands, as it has now done on several different occasions. It seems to me really a flashpoint for a very hot conflict, not perhaps confined to Syria, for that matter. Matt Brodsky, let me turn to a related issue in Israel at the moment. We're told that Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, who has been given the unenviable task of trying to come up with a Middle East peace plan, specifically aimed at resolving the Palestinian conflict with Israel, is poised to unveil what he's come up with. What do we know, if anything, about that plan? And as you see it, Matt, is there a risk that what is pretty much a third ring in this circus is somehow going to be thrust into this middle again at a time when between the Iranian-Saudi-Israeli conflict on the one hand and what's been going on, as you say, in Syria on the next, we're likely to find this an inopportune moment to be trying to foist peace, as they say, on these two parties who haven't been able to fashion it themselves.
Well, I think we have to hand it to President Trump. So far, he has been able to explode a lot of Middle East-related mythologies, and that's been very important, especially when it comes to moving the embassy in Jerusalem. The idea that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is linked to everything else that's wrong in the region, he's really been able to shine a light and show that that's simply not the case. So I think one can certainly argue about the timing. Is this the right time to make, to try a big push for peace? I don't see anything in the Palestinian leadership that leads me to believe that they would accept any kind of deal or that they're even empowered to accept such a deal. Now, that said, we know from the past three negotiation efforts that the U.S. led, and I'm talking about in 2000, 2008, and 2014, we pretty much know where the parameters are and where the disagreements are. And I think what we'll see is Jared Kushner put out a plan somewhere along that line. I've actually been working on a long report that looks at these core issues and these three U.S. attempts before and looks at what the type of proposals that I think we can expect will be. But I think in the end, the fact is the Palestinians won't be able to accept this. And then if the Palestinians are not amenable to a two-state solution, then we have to look at something else in the future. Then we have to either move on or just stand by our Israeli ally.
Mm-hmm. That would suit me, needless to say, and I think the Israelis as well. But Matt, am I not correct that this is the first time that an American administration has presented its own plan? There's been a lot of talk about doing that in the past, but it's my understanding that we've recoiled from doing it heretofore. Would this be breaking new ground in that regard, and is it advisable?
Yes and no. See, In 2000, what we had were the December 23rd Clinton parameters. Now, what they were parameters basically that would just shrink the scope of negotiations to within a certain spectrum. And you had Israel accept it that had reservations within the parameters, and the Palestinians basically rejected it. They said, we'll take it, but all their problems were completely outside of it. So we've had the United States do something like that. We've not really put together a peace plan that says this is exactly it. There's no more negotiations. What you can say is yes or no, period. We've had with Kerry from 2013 to 2014, he created a document with Israel in February 2014. Palestinians rejected it out of hand. He went back to make a separate document in March 2014. So he ended up with a more Israeli-leaning document and a more Palestinian-leaning document than before he was able to bridge the gaps, which arguably would not have been able to happen. The Palestinians decided to blow up the deal and join a whole bunch of UN and international organizations to continue their BDS campaign against Israel.
Boycott, divestment, sanctions. Matt Brodsky, very quickly, lastly, one other thing that's developed recently, which I gather you're pleased at, as am I, was the decision of the Trump administration to withdraw from the UN Human Rights Council. In less than a minute, can you tell us why that is a sensible thing to have done?
Yeah, the UN Human Rights Council is pretty much at the top of all the bad UN bodies. That is an absolute sham of an organization. John Bolton was the ambassador, I believe, in 2006, and he led the effort for the United States not to get into this supposedly new UN Human Rights Council that was a success organization to another UN failure. We tried it throughout the Obama years. The institution cannot be reformed. At some point, when you're bailing water on the ship, it's time to realize the ship is going down. The ship's going down.
Matt Brodsky, much food for thought there. Thank you for joining us and for sharing your thoughts. I hope you'll do so again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Stella Morabito.